You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. And before we get into this conversation with one of my all-time favourite comedians and arguably the comic who had the most influence on me even wanting to be a comedian in the first place, Mr. Simon Munnery, before we get there, just time to remind you that we have now officially launched Everyone's a Comedian. The date is going to be the 14th of August. That's a Monday, 14th of August at 7:30 p.m. There's no tickets. It's completely free. We've no idea if no one will show up or if it'll be rammed. So maybe get there early just in case. And it is at Subway, formerly Movement on Cowgate. That's on the 14th of August. Everyone's a Comedian is, of course, the entirely new, possibly world-first, crowdsourced hour of comedy where you, all of the those of you listening to this who aren't performers in any way, if you've just done one open mic, that's it. You're out of the running, I'm afraid. This is about giving a voice to people, you, the vast majority of you listening to this, who have never performed, have no intention of performing comedy, but still every so often think of a funny thing and have always wondered whether it would work on stage. You can submit that at comedianscomedian.com/experiment. Daryl, hashtag thanks Daryl, will collate all of them and I will be handed them in some sort of order 5 minutes before I go on. I think 5 minutes seems fair, then it'll be more of a crisis. And I attempt to wield your work into a stunning hour of stand-up comedy. So that is officially launched there and you can submit your stuff at comedianscomedian.com/experiment. There's some terms and conditions on there as well. Now, this is Simon Munnery. He is a comic who has had the most influence on my decision to become a comedian. I used to go and see his shows maybe two or three times a year, certainly, at the Edinburgh Festival many, many years ago and to this day. And he is just, he's the person who you most hear me talk about on this show whenever I want to give examples of wording. His is one of the jokes I most frequently use socially to explain how comedy works, that something needs to be surprising yet satisfying. His walking down the road joke, we talk about that a little bit. And he is completely at home, whether building a confusing and highly innovative prop that only lasts a few shows, or singing the works of Soren Kierkegaard, or just coming up with some of the most befuddlingly complex and beautifully simple and elegant comedy writing I've ever heard. This is Simon Munnery. Did you do your first ever gig at the Tunnel Club?
No, but I used to do open spots at the Tunnel. I did gigs at the Tunnel Club, but I'd done open spots at the Tunnel.
And that, you seem to me to be a quintessentially Tunnel Club performer in as much as my understanding of the Tunnel Club. I mean, I know there were also lots of, I mean, lunatics? Do you know what I mean? It was quite, yeah. It was sort of well known for people having a go and then people who were actually good or had the prospect of becoming good and the audience being a monster of that would intentionally enjoy devouring
the acts. Yes, the focus was much more on the audience than any traditional club.
It
was
yes. Like,
what you couldn't do is go down there and trot out your act. So some really good acts, who had a really polished, nice act, I won't name them, but would go down and they would have real trouble. And some, you know, insane people went really well. I mean, actually, probably genuinely insane. And Malcolm liked, I think, getting people who were genuinely insane. I mean, he brought in people borderline insane anyway. Certainly, Chris Luby, RIP.
Yes, yes.
He liked odd people. He was great at that.
Chris Luby used to do the impressions of different
bands
warplanes.
And aeroplanes, yeah. Loved the RAF. Did gig once with him. Anyway, his wife was Indian. That meant he was entitled to an Indian accent when you're having a curry. Just the most awkward, embarrassing bloke to be having a curry with. But anyway, God bless them all. But yeah, the tunnel was... I was there once and they heckled off just as a, you know, just to see it, because it was such a thing to see. It was like, you know, like a bear pit or, you know, Christians versus lions sort of atmosphere. They'd heckled off all the acts within about half an hour. So the evening was over within half an hour. And any other club, that would be like, well, it's a bit of a disaster. There, it was like, it was victory to the tunnel. We died. So, but the thing about it was, if they liked you, they liked you. You know, with no sort of history to it. You know, oh, it's him back again. It was, if you survived the heck, if you cope with what they were going to throw at you.
On that night?
Yeah. Then, you know, they would love something or hate it. Tending towards the hate.
And did you go well there?
I've gone well there, but I've also, I mean, the only recorded footage I think of anyone at the Tunnel Club is me dying on my arm.
I think I've seen that actually. Again,
cab for Simon Munnery, I'll pay, pass that round. But that particular, it was one of the first times I did Alan Parker at Warrior, very early on, but he introduced me, because I'd be doing Simon Munnery as the security guard, I think I was, yes, before that. And Malcolm introduced me as Simon Munnery, Urban Warrior, and that sort of threw me a bit. Anyway, so I did it, not very well, or, you know. But anyway, that character, you know, one in three times would die towards at the beginning. You know, and people take it seriously. They come up and go, oh, I don't think teachers should be equated with police. They don't earn nearly as much. And like, okay, it's a character. Oh, never mind. But, you know, perhaps I wasn't acting it that well. Anyway, or it became clearer as time passed.
And the spirit of that gig, which is kind of, I mean, people have tried to sort of replicate elements of that. I think of something like the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society, yeah, which is sort of like, you know, it's about trying things and failure and the rest of it. But it doesn't have that, it's not, we can't call that an attempt to replicate the Tunnel Club. But I think it does feel in comedy's history in this country like a unique environment.
Yeah.
And I suppose I think of you as someone who was kind of created as a comedian in that crucible,
yes,
of that environment. Is that fair?
I'd agree. No, it was to me, the trick to it is clock up the hours. Like, just do as many gigs as you can. Never mind courses or... I mean, yeah, sure, think about it, whatever. But actually, it's what you can... by clocking up the hours. And take the toughest gigs you can. In a way, grow a... What? Who was it who said to me? Tina Fey, no. Magician, transsexual magician.
Faye Presto.
You, yes, should drive around in a skip. He said, the best thing about this job, you can die and then do it all again the next day. Which is true. You know, but it's underestimated the value of dying, you know, just to go through that experience of it got just shit. Right?
Did you get better at dying? Do you think over the course, not just at the Tunnel Club, but generally, does it, once you've been through that enough times, does, I suppose I would imagine for someone who has done the more experimental, unusual, not less crowd-pleasing, I think, you know, you're obviously very good, you make audiences very happy a lot of the time, but less kind of, you don't make compromises towards what they want. I would imagine from the outside as a much more, I guess, a more kind of mainstream, you know, it's important to me to please them in a way that I wish I could shake off, you know, one of, yeah, those sort of acts. The more you die, do you get better at dying? Do you get better at coping with it? Does it feel any less horrible the 100th time than it does the 10th time? Or the 500th time?
500th time. I've got that book for Sunday. No, I think it's always, the terror's always there, but it's something... you know, that's kind of the hook to it, you know, that you could die. In a way, the worst is when you know, what happens is, as a comedian, after many years, you've got a back pocket full of stuff. You can punch your way out of any gig just by doing a load of jokes and get off, and then you feel it's better to die a noble death, you know. And as she says, you do it all again the next day. You've got to put something in it for yourself. You've got to take some risk and then pay the consequences. And yeah, it won't go well. I mean,
there are two deaths in particular that I think of my own. One of them mercifully a long time ago, one of them horribly recent.
Right.
Where I think they'll be part of me forever.
Yeah.
They'll live in my heart forever. I wonder whether your enjoyment, when does your enjoyment come on stage? If you say that part of you has that kind of like, it's not just the joy of making an audience laugh. And in fact, from I sort of glean from what you said earlier a moment ago, that there is a sort of maverick streak that almost, it's not as good if you can punch your way out every time. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not as satisfying if you're not throwing yourself into real danger.
The best feeling is to try something that you found funny in the day or just thought about at the moment, to try something and it works. And wow, that is... jokes have a sort of rhythm, I think, which is the first time you do it, it goes much better than you expected, and it's an utter joy. The second time, it goes much worse than you expected, because you remember how well it went the next time. Anyway, it kind of levels out and becomes a thing, and then you maybe you hone it a bit, and then you've done it so much you can't do it anymore. But then you leave it in your back pocket for 10 years, and it's been fallow, and you come back to go, oh, that's quite good actually. I can still do that. You know, so they have their own history. But the best thing is to create something at the moment, or have thought of it that day or a week ago, and try it out. Because that, the whole kind of, to me, what it is a research project into what do I find funny that other people find funny. It's about sharing. I mean, I might find something funny, but if it's just me, then it doesn't count for much. It's whether other people laugh at it. And the magic when an audience laughs as one at a thing that you didn't know they would, it's beautiful.
Is that research project, as you put it, is that more important to you than... an idea of success or career or kind of goal fulfilment?
I wish I was richer, but actually, no, I'm very lucky to have got away with it this long, doing something I love. But, you know, I wish I earned more, but that, you know, that doesn't help. My wife wishes I earned more, my children wish I earned more. The dog's happy with me. He's on my side. Does it matter? But, you mean, career-wise, I mean, you know, I don't. What happens, you sort of. I don't worry about that day to day. Well, at this present moment, I'm thinking, what the hell am I going to do on Sunday? I'm at that awkward for me.
Yes.
First preview is throw it all away and just start chucking stuff up a flagpole and two episodes. It's going to be a mess.
The stuff that you're chucking up the flagpole on Sunday
nothing.
Night.
No, really, nothing.
Nothing. Really,
well,
nothing.
I've got notebooks full of notes to look through and go, well, that's an interesting verse, and that's here's a diagram for a thing. Yeah. Oh, something will come of it.
Do you have faith now after, I mean, 30 years?
Yeah, 30
is this
years.
This comic.
Yeah.
Do you have faith now that something will come of it? Or does the idea of Sunday night scare you?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm utterly terrified. I've got friends coming as well. Like, oh, it's going to be so embarrassing because I have... Either I'm going to go, shit, this is, I'll just do some old stuff and, like, you know, try and, you know, just get through it. But isn't the point. I always put myself in this situation, well, first preview, or previews generally... Try stuff. That's what it's for. Because it's very hard. You know, you might try a little bit. So when I do a show in Edinburgh, and then little bits, new bits come in over the tour. But at some point, you have to chuck it all away and start again. It's that moment. Some years, like about 2 years ago, I wrote loads. I had a whole stack of paper. But none of that ended up in it. Almost none. Like, just a few sentences here and there, a few paragraphs. And then last year... I don't know where it came from. There's some old stuff, some very old stuff that had only been performed once, you know, sort of thing, and some anecdotes. But I really liked it by the end. It's like, about a couple of weeks ago, did the last show. I thought, yeah, I'd like that now.
Yes. You're someone whose jokes, we'll talk specifically about the jokes, and I'd like to talk specifically about one-liners for the moment, because okay. I think your ability to write almost kind of, I don't know what the word is, archetypal one-liners. One of the jokes that I most commonly think about of yours is all men are brothers, hence war. Mm. I think that for me, that doesn't just... That's not just a joke. That says something.
Yeah, it's a little... I love a bit of philosophy. I love Nietzsche and Kierkegaard. And I like... It's a bit like poetry, but I like the thing of getting a thought down to as minimum words. A couple of years ago, at McCuntleth, Comedy Festival, I thought of this joke. Well, I thought of a punchline to it. I thought of this joke. And it was a late night kind of... you know, festival show, you know, lots of acts on, and I was pretty drunk, but I thought, can I go on and just do my new joke? I just thought of it. All right, yeah. So I did it, and it went all right. And then I was sort of walking away. I was out of the venue, I was having an appointment. No, yeah, I can do that better. You know, I did it four times. By the end, I had it down to four words.
What was the joke?
Originally, it was, I've got some friends, you know, and they're clowns. They work in the clown industry. And well, they're married to each other, but got children and that. But it's not working out at the moment, and they're going to get divorced. Probably going to be a custody battle. Okay, it's not worth the palaver, isn't worth trying this fake backstory. What it ended up was four words: clowns divorce, custody battle.
Yes, okay.
You, again, it's tricky one. You've got to say it just right, and, yeah, but over a few hours, right, but in front of the same audience, obviously. But the fourth time they'd heard it, it had lost some of its charm. The thing about jokes.
So your writing process for something like that, or for the All Men Are Brothers, or for What Do You Get the Man Who Has Everything, might I suggest a tombstone engraved with the words "So What"? Mm. Those kind of like boiling the idea down. What do you start with? You said with the custody battle one, you start with the idea of like the word custody, the double meaning of that word.
I don't know how I start. No, to be honest, it's a mystery, even to both do it. It's like, as Kierkegaard says, jokes from the mysterious source of the inexplicable, such that not even the wittiest of men dares to say tomorrow, but when it pleased the gods. So, right, I don't have a process. Sometimes things occur to me. Like, for a long time, I've had this thing about Sainsbury's.
Yes.
My Sainsbury's songs.
And
I loved them. Basically, football chants pro-Sainsbury's, so I'm against all other supermarkets. But, you know, I was taking the dog just for a walk around there, and I knew there were other supermarkets since I didn't, you know, but I hadn't thought of anything to do. And about halfway around walking, I thought, Lidl, smells like piddle, food round the outside, junk in the middle. Bang! And then, just on the way back, I thought, Aldi, are you Lidl in disguise? Nothing but a bad anagram. Bang! So now I'm going to do that. That's this year, right?
Yeah.
But that entitles me to do the old Sainsbury's as well. And I'm going to try and add, take them all down, Waitrose, MS. One stop. You know, anyway, I'm going to expand that bit. So, like, for example, I did a thing called The Two Confessions of Sherlock Holmes, which is in Malcolm Hardy's mm-hmm. book, Sit Down Comedy. It's like, you know, I don't know how many, few thousand words. But that just started off as one joke, and it just stayed as that joke for years. And then I had to write something, and I kind of thought, oh, I'll just carry it on. So,
what was the one joke? What was
it? It was the opening line, which was The True Confessions of Sherlock Holmes. The first two cases were a fluke. After that, I coasted on my laurel.
I just remember from that voice. Is that the one that has a reference to Quarquas and Merlin bats? Yeah, okay. So this is Simon. An enormous pleasure to talk to Simon, particularly, as you can hear, on a beautiful day with a little bubbling, babbling brook behind us and tweeting and the noise of grass growing and so on. Now, there is extra content for this episode. If you go to comedianscomedian.com extras, you can hear some extra bits of chat about the near riot, of which Simon was the epicentre and in which a young Stu Goldsmith slightly participated many years ago. And you can hear Simon's thoughts on success. You can hear all about his previous obsession with audience numbers. That's fascinating. And also his invention of a better saucepan, not to mention a little cheeky anecdote to do with Banksy. All of that stuff is available if you join the mailing list at comedianscomedian.com/extras. And if you're already on the mailing list, then your email address will act as your little key to download all of that stuff on MP3. I'll chat to you a little bit more at the end of this episode. I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. Let's get straight back into it. Just a little reminder, if you'd like to donate to the show, please do. I've got to do a big shout out to Ren and the Good Doctor, who gave me a three-figure donation for the show, which is one of the biggest I've ever had. not one of the biggest three-figures ones. Those really don't crop up all that often, as you can imagine. But thank you so much. You're supporters of my stand-up. You come and see me live. I know. It's great to have met you. And thank you so much for
not just the money, but also what the money means. I'm enormously proud of this podcast whenever anyone is moved to donate, and even when they're not, even when you send me nice emails, or I just overhear someone on a bus talking about the show who doesn't know I'm there. How exciting. But I'm very proud of this show, and every time someone makes an effort, I've had another decent donation too from a mystery benefactor who knows who she is, so thank you very much to you. The majority of donations, of course, are much less sparkly and exciting than that, but no less appreciated. Thank you to everyone. I've emailed you all. I get back to everyone that donates. And if you would like to be one of their number and hear exactly what it is that I say, then or variations thereof, then you can donate at comedianscomedian.com/donate. Or, of course, you can go there and set up a recurring payment if you'd like to for £1, £2, £5 a month. And even some lunatics are even going a tenner a month. I mean, there's like three of them in the world, but it's enormously appreciated. And if you'd like to be part of that, then please don't let me stand in your way. If, of course, you're unable to donate, then you are one of the beneficiaries of the people who can donate, paying so that you don't have to. So to Ren and Ms. B and all of the other people who I never know if I should be identifying you. Perfectly happy to identify Ren, it would seem, but I think her and the GD will be very happy to be officially recognised. Thank you so much. If you're someone that donates in any form, I appreciate it enormously, and more power to you. If, of course, you're someone who can't or chooses not to donate, then please do share the show, give me a decent review on iTunes, particularly if you're in a different country to the UK, and that helps more people discover it. And that's great. So I hope you'll come along and see my own Edinburgh show, not just Everyone's a Comedian on the 14th of August at 7:30 p.m. That's a little one-off show, but also my show, Like I Mean It, who, as you'll know if you listened to last week's episode, is now firing on all cylinders and ready to roll. I cannot wait to get up to the festival. What a relief after months of, is it okay? Is it going to be okay? Oh, God, can I do it again? I can't do it again. Now I'm like, I've done it again. I'm going to do it again, harder, more, better, faster, stronger, at 3:45 p.m. daily from the 5th to the 27th at the Liquid Rooms Annex. I'll see you there for Like I Mean It. That'll do for now. Let's get back to the second half of this interview with the absolutely wonderful Simon Munnery.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So when it came to, and let's talk about the League Against Tedium for a bit, because that was as I said, my first introduction to you, and that I think was, that seemed to me like the holding place. So I don't know what I'm miming here. That seemed like a really good way for you to bang out lots of philosophical one-liners. It seemed like the perfect character for that, in the way that the security guard would do security guard-based jokes. Yeah. Alan Parker would do jokes about class and status, and then with League Against Tedium, it seemed to me just you'd found a different type of voice with that character.
Yeah, I think so.
That you would, and I always envisaged you, and this is one of my first thoughts about the writing process of a comedian. I thought, have you sat down with like a book of aphorisms or, you know, epigrams, and then gone through them and spent a bit of time on each one going, how can I tweak this? How can I find another meaning in this? You know, the watched pot never boils, things like that.
There's
so many of them that seem to be based on, they're kind of riffs on existing.
Yes, so obviously any kind of Right, so the sort of idea of the Legal Insidium was it's Mr. Loser's revenge on the world. So he's entitled to look at any philosophy, anything anyone's ever said, and by adding something, twist it, undermine it, or make it his own. So I did, but I didn't like, go through Nietzsche looking for something I could nick and alter. I liked, I find Nietzsche quite funny, quite a lot of it. Everything about woman is a riddle. Everything about woman has one solution. It is called pregnancy. Right? That's one of his.
Okay.
Well, I think that is funny. there's another Nietzsche one that made me laugh. It's, the idea is something... What makes me laugh about Nietzsche, this particular line by Nietzsche, which is to get up at the break of day and in all the dawn and freshness of one's strength to read a book, I call that vicious. It's the idea of the pen being put, you know, the full stop, pen down, strutting around the garden.
Yes, nailed it. Yeah. Table over.
That kind of the arrogance of the one line philosophize with a sledgehammer attitude of Nietzsche is really what drove that. And then I added some technology on top. The first ever performance of Legal Insidium was at the Canal Cafe Theatre. There were three people in the audience. It'd take me two trips from Haringey, where I lived, on the tube with all these props. And I set up this thing with a lectern, which I'd built, and two arms that came out of it, and barbed wire between them. So there's a barbed wire barrier between me and the audience. Two buckets with stage maroons, explosives, which I rigged myself with wires up to these buttons on the thing, and a huge inflatable man, which was basically a fan, hot air, a cold air, you know, fan, like, attached to two dustbin liners attached together, so that when I pressed a button, this thing would spring up to life, and I had on a Walkman tape, it would argue with me. It was the modern man. I had the argument with the modern man. Anyway, and the explosives were... It was an utter disaster. There were, of the audience of three, two were Dutch, and it meant nothing to them, and I packed it away, and I didn't give it. I just kept doing it until eventually it worked.
There's something about this, the status of the league, and that kind of, like you say, the loser's revenge on the world.
That's if you get it. If you don't, it's really annoying. Like it worked. It worked in Edinburgh. It worked in Manchester. It worked in London. It was funny. And I'd done Alan Parker in Melbourne the year before. Went over to Melbourne to do it. Something that begins with Verdi's Requiem and Attention Scum, you are nothing, absolutely nothing, in an English accent.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And Australians are really nice. They're going, what are you being rude to us for? Right? And if you don't find that funny, it's a really fragile show. I hadn't realised how fragile, because it's always gone well before that.
Yes, or, it's so ballistic. It's such a kind of steamroller.
Either you find being abused by them before, you find Attention Scum, you think you're so rawr, but you're not even meow. Either you find that funny, or you're offended, in which case I'm not going to dig it back when I finally come on. and there it went. It was full the first night, and then it went down and down and down to about, it was 250, down to 100, about 100, and then I've sort of pulled it back to about 134. I'd go really get used, particularly at that time, obsessed by numbers, but anyway. So it just, and it didn't go well, except for one night where accidentally, I don't know how, I did it, I was camp, right? Just much more camp with it. And people were crying, laughing on the way out, right? The next night, I tried to do it camp. And that didn't... I wasn't camp. It was worse. Yeah. So there was something in that. And then the other time...
Just before we move on, what was that about, do you think? The campness making it work? What unlocked it for them?
Why? Well, it's... if you're camp, you're sort of allowed to be bitchy. A kind of bitchy camp wit or vicious camp wit is kind of...
I'm just trying to think what would be different about that, though, that they hadn't liked the previous night. For me, the line in that show where you go, you know, you're doing knock knock, who's there? The sea. Oh, my old enemy. That to me is just like, how can you not laugh at that? How can you could you mistake that arrogance for real arrogance?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why it didn't work. I mean, it had worked, but in Australia it didn't. And also, I was booked to do a festival in Toronto. Well, I thought it was a festival. And I said to people, are you going to Toronto Festival? Going, I've never heard of it. I don't know. Anyway, I got there. It wasn't a festival. It was just me. Right, this bloke, he was a... not a very nice bloke. He was an accountant, but he wanted to be a theatrical producer before his 30th birthday. And he looked through the brochure and he wanted Dave Gorman, but he wasn't available, so he picked me to do the Legal Insidium. In Toronto for 5 weeks in this theatre that had been dark for 6 years. It hadn't been used, and it was a huge church, about 300, 400 seater, with a balcony. Anyway, open up, there's two follow spot operators. But again, the same thing, as in, they just, after the beginning, attention to you, another thing, they were on the, they weren't, they were annoyed, offended by it. And, you know, did my best, did it all. But numbers went down. And I asked him, I begged him, could I do Alan Parker over Memorial, which I knew I'd done in Canada. I knew it worked. I knew I could. No, I booked this show. I believe in it. You do it. Anyway, one matinee, my numbers were just going down, like to, 10, 15 people. There was one matinee when there were three in. I mean, we've got two follow spot operators, stage manager, two bar staff, me, three people in the audience. And after the first half, I was sitting outside in the sun having my customary half time beer. I went back on and started banging it out to the whole room, and then realised, oh, something's changed. Two people have gone. It's just you. And there's this bloke with a beard. So I just did it all straight to him, and he laughed his head off. But there's something about performing to one person in a 500-seat theatre. That's as embarrassing as it can get, really. Tunnel Club, that.
That reminds me of a joke you used to have where you would say to the audience, do you ever feel completely and totally alone? Off chance that one person would go, yes.
Hoping. No. And when it did, it's perfect. Anyone here felt totally alone? Yeah. Oh, just you then. But you've got to hope it's just one person. And the one time that went, right, how am I? My wife, I was doing at Melbourne, and I was doing Alan Parker, and I'd done my show, gone really well, and doing the late night fringe show, whatever it's called, the late night show. And I remember I was cocky in the dressing room going, how long have you been doing it? 15 years. I was kind of impressed by myself. Probably had a bit of a smoke. Anyway, I went on and I went, right, I did one joke from the show, bang, and then, right, Melbourne, got any issues? I wanted them to shout something, and I was going to, wanted to improvise. And someone at the back shouts out, repetitious comedians. And the character just went out of me. I just lost my temper. What do you mean, repetitious comedians? I did one joke, then I asked to improvise, and you go, that's just so unfair. Anyway, the sort of London skin shone through. Anyway, and I tried to dig it back and become Alan Parker again, but it didn't work. Nothing was working. And at one point, I did that joke. I went, anyone here ever felt totally alone? Massive laugh, because I was dying on my arse. Right? And then one person perfectly goes, yes. And I went, oh, just you then. Nothing.
Oh.
And I went, no. That was funny. That was funny. that was the mood. Said, I realised Alan Parker wasn't working. I couldn't do it anyway. I was just in sort of a strange state. I said, I started trying to describe the Lee Gates Stadium and that I would be wearing a different costume, and started doing about it. And then I did a bit about, which is part of the Lee Gates Stadium became, which was the actual Supreme Supremacy, which was a Michael Caine voice about the Church of England. Started doing that, some bits about Jesus. That was going for nothing. Every so often I would get a laugh. Like, I said, what am I doing wrong? To blow him from him, what am I doing wrong? And he went, you're too polite, mate. And I went, oh, I'm sorry. That got a laugh.
Yeah.
But none of my material would, and I couldn't find a way through it. So, and eventually I got this heckle, which was, and I've been talking about Jesus about a minute before, this heckle, which was, don't die. Don't die. And the thought came to me, the reply came to me was, where were you at the crucifixion? Because that would have been a good time to shout that. But the mood I was in was such, I changed it, where were you at Calvary? Which may be wrong, it might be Calgary, it's one of the two. But anyway, but that cuts out 80% of the audience anyway. I got a tiny laugh. I remember I backed off the stage, but I did my time. Anyway, happy days.
And that little voice was Janet.
That was my wife, yes. To be.
So your approach to 30 years worth of comedy has been, is it fair to call it kind of scattergun? You've done lots of different characters, lots of different things. You'll do OHP slides and paintings and the Jesus kind of puppet show.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of things, a lot of different things. Why is that? Why have you done so many different things? Are you kind of serving your own Do you get bored with things easily? Or do you, I mean, has it occurred to you to go, I'm going to do this one and stick to that?
I think it's...
Or does that not interest you?
It does. I don't do this one thing. Well, I did Alan Parker about... maybe 20 years. Right, so that's doing one thing and honing it and getting better at it,
but presumably at the same time as doing lots of other stuff.
Well, the league and season came up with sort of in parallel, but so yeah, I've done the same. I'm quite happy doing the same thing over and over, but it's more like I think of something that makes me laugh and I want to see if other people find it funny. So like, and I have particularly pursued the visual, like doing visual things like the overhead projectors or cardboard animations. I want to that's a thing I have, I keep coming back to, and then going, bloody hell, I can't carry any more props around, I'm sick of it. I'll have a year off from that and try and get away without it. So I vary between the visual and just speech. But no, I think of a thing and then I have to do it and pursue it until I give it up, or it gives me up. Like I think if you have an idea, you're the servant of that idea. That's how it works for me.
So when you... It's interesting because I often like asking people what they're working on at the moment. And as we've established, you're working on zero, what the hell do I do in 48 hours? Well, but in terms of what's on in your notebook at the moment,
yeah.
What bit of something that doesn't yet exist are you feeling most confident in it having some mileage in? Like, is there a particular note that sticks out that you think, I think there's something in this?
No, I just have faith that something will turn up. It may not, in which case it'll be a disaster, but that's all right. These things are sent to try us. So there is a bit... No, well, there's... I've got about four jokes that are new. There's that little bit, mm-hmm. right? So there's the things I've tried, and there's a thing I've been doing, which is... I've done about twice now, but I really love doing it, so... That's going to be fun. Which is, you're digging away in the heap, and you find a shoe. Oh, it's a good shoe, really good shoe. You know, it's not been worn hardly. You think, oh, shoe, yes, got me another one. You're down there, you're digging in the heap. You think, oh no, of course there's not going to be another shoe. Of course not. No one throws away a pair of shoes. They throw away one shoe. It's the one that's been lost. With one shoe. You know, the market for, you know, one-legged men are thin on the ground, literally. What you can do, anyway, on for a bit about the shoe and what you can do with it. You end up burying it again and you think, oh no, someone's done this before, in the heap. I know what you're thinking, third world problems. Okay, so it's all for that. That's what it's all okay. for. But I really enjoy doing that bit about, you know, it's like, so that's a thing I'm going to enjoy doing.
And in that example, third world problems is almost like... That's not your favourite bit of the joke. That's like the bit that legitimise. That's like the end that you can rely on, so that you can enjoy yourself doing the digging, mime, and the exploring the idea.
Yeah, indeed. And also, I really, I find the phrase "first world problems" annoying.
Yeah.
So let's just try the opposite. Maybe that's a whole format. Maybe that's a whole, you know, coal seam of, you know, you do another routine which is end up with third world problems. You know, you're working in the factory and you've got to sign the contract not to kill yourself. Ooh. You know, you go upstairs and you're trying to get out, but they've got nets.
You are credited with some of my favourite quotations, almost like views on comedy. I believe you, it was you who came up with, it's not a race, it's a dance, with reference to comedy
as
a career.
It's not a marathon, it's a sprint. No, it's not a race, it's a dance.
Yes, yeah. Which saved my life in 2010 when I was having a tough year. I remember thinking, as soon as I thought that, it was my first year of doing an hour at Edinburgh, I was so happy because I was just regarding doing a show that year as all it was a gift to myself. It was like a victory lap for having managed to write an hour, which is something I'd wanted to do for years and years. And I was so happy. And then the day before the nominations, I was a technical newcomer. I was eligible for newcomer, as many people are each year. And the day before the nominations came out, people started going, oh, you must be excited about the thing. And I was like, no, haven't thought about it. What? And then it got in my head for 24 hours. Didn't get nominated for anything, of course. And I say, of course, not because I'm terrible, but because, you know, a very limited amount of people are. It's a ridiculous number.
it's as if it wasn't stressful enough doing a show for a month. But they add a competition element.
Yeah, exactly.
To it.
Exactly.
Like, oh, just making a living's hard.
So that phrase, it's not a race, it's a dance. And I think another one that Stuart Lee has credited you with, or brought to my attention, was if the crowd are behind you, you're facing the wrong way.
If the crowd gets behind you, it means you're facing the wrong way. I did another one. I added to that. Well, right, then I forgot what it was. Something about if the crowd on your left, it means you're lying down or something. Anyway, but there's more to do with geometry. Like, but it means two things, doesn't it? The crowd gets behind you, like a Nazi rally sort of thing. If you're slagging off the Muslims and everyone's laughing, you're a cunt, I think. What I'm saying there is, you're sort of the role of the performer is to be against the crowd to some extent, to take them somewhere new. But
rather than to confirm what they already believe and be carried shoulder high for saying
any
the thing
kind
they
of
agree with.
Performer, that is something of your job, vocation. But maybe not. People can feel
weird. Where does that, because I'm really interested in that philosophy of it. Where does that idea come from? Does that come from your own? I don't mean the joke. I mean the premise of
the idea.
Does that come from your own? Does that come from you seeing people get an easy ride by pandering to an audience and that frustrating you? Or does it come? Where does that originate? This idea that you should be against, that you should somehow be contrary to the audience.
Probably Nietzsche. Nietzsche and, you know, being the... Kierkegaard, the single individual and the truth and something of the role of the priest, maybe. There's a kind of a philosophy of comedy of saying the unsayable and that sort of area. I don't know. I really don't know. Well, I just think there's something... That thought occurred to me and I thought, there's something in that. Nietzsche says something like, if I contradict myself, so what? I'm paraphrasing, isn't he? He said it more eloquently. But, yeah, okay. But that, even if that thought isn't, clonk, 100% true, there's a truth to it. There is space there. It's not just telling people what they want to hear. You should tell them what they don't want to hear and try and make them not mind having heard it. Give them their money back. That's the way.
So have you become the sort of comedian that you anticipated you would? What did you when you started doing stand-up, what did you anticipate from
I don't
from
know
comedy?
I didn't I just started doing it. Loved doing it, carried on doing it. The wind change, you get stuck like that. I never had a plan or anything. My basic philosophy is to say yes to things, whatever turns up. I've not been particularly proactive. A while back, just like the idea of having a meeting with a TV producer or something. I don't want to do that again.
Was that after? This is after Attention Scum kind of made and then announced it was not going to be recommissioned before it went out.
Yeah, not just that, but also I did a pilot for Alan Parker pilot for BBC Two that was broadcast. Didn't need to be broadcast. A lot of the best road to be on if you want to do TV is non-broadcast pilots. You get paid and everything, but it doesn't go out until you don't put it out till it's ready. I wasn't very particularly good at arguing with people. I knew my character and what I wanted to do, but what Alan Parker would do as a set, which was one big joke, which was like some huge Dr. Martin boots, like they tried to build a model of himself, but it had been too big, so there's half of it there and half of it there. That's for one sort of visual joke, but we ended up with a set like The Word and Dancing Girls, and it was kind of. Some good stuff. Graham Linhan co-wrote on it, and there were some good little sketches. And I had a dreadful cold that day. I was on tour, so I can't be tour. But having lost a lot of battles about little things, having to argue about things, I thought, one of the great things about stand-up is the freedom that you can think of a thing and do it. That's what I really love, the freedom. You think of it, do it, you don't ask a committee, you don't check it. Although, having said that, it's great to be in a double act when you can bounce off someone else. But you can just try it. And see, and there's no asking, you just do it. And TV is sort of the opposite of that. You have to wade through a lake of treacle to get and then it won't be quite what you wanted.
And I suppose in terms of the way you were describing before, like it being a research project to find out if they laugh and what you laugh. There's not really any room for that within TV. You can't really try things in the same way.
I suppose
or
not.
Or there's too much. There's too many other people's jobs and nights and all, money.
It's also important. Yeah.
Yeah, it's important. So is that something that's kind of at the centre of your practice as a comedian, which is that it can't be too important because that means you can't get out of it the thing that you want to get out of it. Could you envisage a way for you to happily do TV?
Yeah.
For it to work.
I mean,
to serve your interest in comedy. What would need to be different?
Complete control. I suppose just which I had. So that my camera-based film show was sort of an attempt to do that in a way with guests, people, you know, just speaking directly through a camera. And then, you know, it's a rudimentary way of making TV live in front of the audience, people actually seeing it.
Mm.
That was very interesting, if that could be made to work. It did work, and it does work. But I'm sort of leaving it fallow for a bit, and I don't want to cart cameras around for a bit. I did it for about 5 years. So every so often I leave something and hopefully come back to it.
Have you pitched that as a TV show finally?
No, I never have, because I don't know, it seemed to me utterly obvious it should be a TV show. It just is a TV show. That's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it literally is a TV show.
And it works. And there was a little bit of time where I went, well, I'm surprised the world hasn't noticed and come up to me and gone, hey, that's just a brilliant method of making very cheap TV that works. And we know it works because the audience are laughing at what they're seeing. And then we at home can laugh with them at the same thing. That is surely it. But no.
So is that a case of... It sounds to me, I mean, I sometimes feel similarly, or have felt similarly, about the world of TV, in that you do a thing, presumably people want to put this on TV. Probably people who've made a lot of TV would say, that's not the way it works, you've got to beat the door down to, you know, you've got to apply. At the very least, you've got to say to someone, would you like to put this on TV?
Yeah.
And it strikes me that that's not a very Simon thing to do.
No, probably, crippling shyness or... It's also the thing when they're making TV, lots of people have to be involved to justify it being on TV. In a way, maybe it's too simple. But, you know, I should put it out on the internet. I've got all this footage of loads of people doing pretty well talking through a camera with images. But then, it's just stored. Oh, well. Never mind.
Like, it seems to me, like, it's just with that specific example, if you've got this kind of treasure trove of really good, funny material that you're not putting out into the world, like, I'm going to ask you a challenging question. I don't necessarily mean this, I'm just interested in it. Is it laziness?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, also, well, I suppose, I should write to BBC, maybe. I should write to someone at the BBC and have a meeting and... show them some footage, see what they think. Yes, you're right. Okay, let's get on with that. I'll start Monday. Meanwhile, I've got this next show to panic about. So it's all there. I even did it at the BBC. You know, the BBC has its own compound in Edinburgh.
Yes.
And this huge screen, and I plugged my system into their huge screen and did it in front of 300 people, laughed their heads off. Right, that's in front of... And there were top BBC executives in the audience.
Yeah.
Right, and still, no one... I just thought... Okay, well... You know that thing that works? Do you think maybe... No one said anything. So, yeah, that's an interesting... It's also... It might be like, oh, yeah, that's your act.
Yeah.
Whereas, to me, it's a format. That's just a really...
Yes.
As I say in it, my theory is the camera amplifies the face in the same way the microphone amplifies the voice, and it is an instrument that should be used by live performers. In a sentence, that's it. And... But no.
Do you have a manager who should be kicking down doors on your behalf?
I do have an agent. Agent Tom, he's in New York. I did have a manager for him, so I prefer having an agent, really.
Oh, what's the difference? I've never understood.
20 quid a week. What is the difference? A manager sort of makes decisions, I suppose, supposedly makes decisions for you, whereas an agent sort of just... A manager is more proactive, I think.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. But I don't know. He's capable of thinking of himself. I'm sure he must have thought about it. But, yeah, I'll ask him. Well, when you get onto the BBC,
this is all working for me, because I suppose for me, part of the reason to do, I've got different kind of ulterior motives, I suppose, for any of the interviews that I do. And I suppose for me, part of it is like coming to see you in Edinburgh and then coming back and, you know, bringing friends with me. Part of me wants to go, come on, world, make Simon incredibly successful.
Yeah. Well, it would have happened by now if it was going to happen. Well, maybe I am. Maybe I am incredibly successful.
Well, maybe. I mean, we're sat here next to an artificially babbling brook.
Yeah. Look,
in a beautiful location.
Fish are alive in the pond. Sun's shining.
So what's the relationship then between the two processes of giving them what they don't know they want, giving them what you want them to have, and trying to listen to what it is that they're enjoying? Because with that, and it's slightly to do with what you were just saying there, but also what we've talked about generally, you want to surprise the audience, you want to be contrary to them somehow, but at the same time, when you're trying material, something works or it doesn't. So to a certain extent, you are led by what they're enjoying.
Yes, I think if you've done this any length of time, it's because you love laughter and you love it when they laugh. So I remember seeing Kenneth Williams when he was alive. Obviously, he was doing a book launch for John Lahr's biography of Joe Orton, and it was a book launch tour, and it was John Lahr, biographer of Kenneth Williams, Joe Orton, talking to Kenneth Williams, friend of Joe Orton. Mm-hmm. And Kenneth Williams was hilarious, but when anyone laughed in the room, he was drawn to it like a moth to a flame, which made it funnier. You know, so someone was laughing particularly loudly. So anyway, drawn to laughter. No, you're always listening to whether something works or not. I don't think you think, oh, that works, tick, cross, but it's like, I didn't do that very well, or, you know, self-critical. Well, comedians are often very self-critical, much more so than is justified. Like, it might have been the audience. I used to done shows before where I've played little films at the beginning. Like, it's right at the beginning, so sometimes they go, just storm it. Right? Just hilarious. Other times, the next day, you know, nothing, a titter. You know, this isn't a level playing field, is it? I'm assuming, because I'm in the same room and there's roughly the same number of people, that it's the same. But no, it isn't. A crowd can vary. They can not get it. Little tip, I always think, someone told me this, I can't remember who it was, but don't worry if they don't laugh. They're saving the laugh up for later.
Like, that's nice.
That's a nice one, isn't it? If it doesn't work, it's in the past. Don't worry about it. You know, move on.
Yes.
It's when you... Da, 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 da. Nothing. Even then, you know, death. Mr. As Philippe Goliot said, Mr. Flop, he come, he's good, he come, because I can't really do him. But
did you do his clown workshops?
Did his clown workshops twice? Yeah.
When was that?
Oh, I can't remember. I'm very really bad at dates.
But like
10 years,
10,
ago,
20.
Probably. Before children, so it's got to be 15 years ago at least.
Okay, because loads of comics are doing Goliot now.
Is he still alive?
Yes, he's still teaching.
He's a frightening face. I can never look in his face. He goes through it. It was one moment. No one had everyone had a moment at some point. It's multinational. What comedians do is come on and defend themselves with jokes, whereas what clowning is finding out. It's inviting people to laugh at you. What is funny about you? They find you your clown, but it's like, what's funny about you? I'll give you an example. There's a Swiss street performer, juggler, big Swiss, sort of German Swiss, and he'd been funny once throughout the whole course. And Philippe goes, "So who has not had a moment?" And he puts, "Right, you get up there, I'll get up. Okay, start talking. Okay, louder. No. Okay, you kick him up the ass. You kiss him. No." So he's fiddling around with this bloke's performance. In front of us all, and it's just really awkward. And he said, "No, sir, okay, louder, no, now shout." And this Swiss person, like, it was a very awkward position for him anyway, but he starts shouting, and it was so funny. Just, we were all just crying with laughter. And I went up to him afterwards, going, "Oh, that was so funny." And he was then in tears, because we just laughed at him. It was what was funny about him,
yes.
This angry, uptight Swiss bloke. And I hadn't, on that, the previous course, I'd had a few moments, but I hadn't had one that one. He said, all right, get up, okay, you kick him up the ass, you kiss him, okay, speak louder, okay, okay, now, speak, but don't make any sound. Speaking but not making any sound. And again, they all were laughing. It was, I was like being on quite a wide tightrope, right? Wow.
Okay.
This is funny. I'm being funny in a kind of way I knew, but anyway, I sit down and he goes, your clown, it is intellectual wanker. Which the league is a sort of intellectual wanker, which I'd been doing, and I kind of knew that, but I didn't know it in the same way as deprived of all jokes. That's what's funny about you.
And did that experience inform what you then did, the work you made next? Did you change anything about what you were doing?
Not consciously. I felt, it's like a penny had dropped or something. It was like, I'd been doing the League at City, which was an act, which is sort of an intellectual wanker with his thoughts, and here are my thoughts, you know. To confirm. But also to find that space of not, without words, without jokes, just something about that kind of character. I suppose it might have improved it a bit. I think to begin with, it made it go worse because I was trying too hard to do something else. Yeah. But fingers crossed, I think it did good. I'd recommend doing Golio.
That idea of going on stage with like a comedian going on with jokes to protect him. And I've always thought, I've done some clowning workshops, not for a long time now, but I always felt my problem, I kind of far enough out of them now to go, I couldn't take responsibility. I couldn't let them laugh at me. I don't know, it's something to do with school and kind of feeling. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh God.
I think it's perfectly natural not to want that.
Spent years trying to protect myself from attack. Yeah. And actually, one of my most enjoyable things to do on stage now is genuinely not know what I'm going to say next. And that you really have to throw yourself into difficulty and pursue an idea. And then, of course, the problem is, if that works, you then try and fake it the next night. And you're like, no, this isn't the thing that was good. This is me trying to fake the genuine moment of the previous night.
Yeah, well, that's what I've got to do on Sunday.
Yeah.
Something like that. Tell you something. I mean, in my last show, I did a bit, which when I first did the so-called annual general meeting, the whole idea of that was, I had a fully written one-man play, Buckethead Way of the Bucket, or Buckethead Phenomenon and on and on, which was written. I'd honed it over a couple of years, done. And I decided to show at the Stand, I'm a massive fan of Phil Kay. Mm-hmm. I used to, in Adelaide, when I first saw him, I was a show after him, and I used to watch him, the end of his show was always totally different. And he'd be telling jokes and stuff, and people would be walking out backwards, still laughing, time was up. Just still going. Force nature. And when I came back from Adelaide that time, 25 years ago, used to do every other Monday the new material, like at the Camden Head, Islington. And I used to do what I call my Phil Kay experiments, which is I go on deliberately with nothing and try and Phil Kay it up. And sometimes it worked, or read the telephone directory. But, just give myself some stupid challenge and try and do it. My last show I had a bit, which was, let's play, I've got beginning, middle, end, nothing else. Let's play just an hour. And I asked them to, just a minute, but shorter and not rigged. I asked someone to think of a subject, and then I'd actually try and do it, and they go, bzzz. But that is so hard. I mean, I 20 seconds maybe I managed to make talking about the thing. And that's what I don't like about set list is the... I've done it quite a lot. I enjoy doing it at the time, but it's a bit like eating a late night McDonald's or something. I feel sick afterwards and slightly ashamed, because there's a propensity to go down the base route when you're making stuff up and you're kind of getting desperate for a laugh. You'll say bum or poo or something, you head that way, and then on top of that, a lot of the subjects they give you on set list are kind of chicken fucking in the Bahamas, or they're kind of based as well, so there's sort of double. And also it's comedy without a safety net. Well, comedy is without a safety net. It just is, like, that's how it is. And actually, by saying it's without a safety net, that is giving it a safety net. So it's much easier than it looks. But then I end up, so do this just a minute thing for a little bit, and then someone will go, hesitation, deviation, repetition, and I go, yep, fair enough.
All right, you'll go.
So I found an out to it, and that, and it became just that, rather than I wasn't even trying to improvise anymore. I just sort of do it for a bit and do the punchline.
And know that you can get out.
Yeah. But it's always fun to be able to, like, you know, I'd start doing banter with someone, and then that would become part of the show, and then I wouldn't really be trying to do banter anymore. I'd just be recalling the previous banter. It's all right. I'm glad you do quite a lot of banter on Sunday. Where are you from, please?
I've watched a lot of your clips on YouTube to refresh my memory before I realised that I could pretty much remember most of your work anyway, from a certain period at least. But something I did notice was that your... a lot of people in the comments under your YouTube videos reference Stuart Lee and the fact that they've been sent there by Stuart somehow. You know, he's like referred to a lot in his books, and he's kind of credited you as like he's borrowed some of your jokes. You know, in the same year, I think, as he did an article about how comedians who use writers are cheating, and you know, he's going to borrow some of your lines for his series.
Probably, I don't qualify as a writer.
Yeah, well, there we go. It's a loophole. It's clip law, perfect. Yeah. So it struck me. I mean, one of the things I noticed from that is that he commands, or maybe he doesn't command, he is subject to an enormous audience, a lot of whom seem to watch his stuff because they love him, and a lot of whom seem to watch his stuff because they hate him, which must be quite an unwieldy position to be in.
I think he's doing all right.
Yeah, I think he's doing fine. But you're very divisive in the comments of the videos.
I'm glad I haven't looked at it because
don't do me any good. Don't look at it. but for as many people as there are saying this is absolute genius, this is incredible, there's a lot of people going, I not just don't get it, but I hate it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? In the way that...
That's probably why I'm not massively successful, because half the people who seem to hate me.
Well, I think of acts like Ed Axel.
Yeah.
Who I've never seen anyone divide a room like Ed Axel.
I quite like that.
I love it.
First time I saw Jerry Sadowitz, right? So, a comedy store, and I was just gone down there to see if I could get an open spot or something like that. And there'd been an American comic on, and I'd laughed a couple of times. He was quite good. And then Jerry Sadowitz comes on and goes, "I fucking hate fucking American comics," like, and names the bloke. It was just so... They come over here, they see things like, "Have you ever noticed how blind people can't do crosswords? Have you fucking noticed? Have you fucking..." And he's telling jokes at such speed, and so offensive as well, some of them, that there were waves of different sound crossing the audience, right? Some people would be laughing from one joke, and other people would be going from the one before. You know, these different waves of laughter and horror crossed the audience, and made it so exciting. Like seeing, I imagine, I never saw, like the Sex Pistols in the early, you know, it was just, wow, the energy. And it was like a living gargoyle on speed. Not that he was, I don't think, but he was just something in his heyday. Oh, he's probably still brilliant. I haven't seen him for a while. Yeah, that thing of dividing room. I do like it when a room's divided. It's something interesting.
Yes. Well,
I don't seek to divide a room.
No.
It's just
but
what
nor
happens.
Do you nor do you make concessions to, like, you could, one would imagine you could look at your 30-year back catalogue, just choose all of your most reliable stuff. Mm. And try to be a reliable club act.
I'm not calling you
an unreliable act, but what I mean is you could divide rooms less if you wanted to, and you've sort of chosen to pursue what it is that excites you.
That's it. I'm afraid it's just entirely selfish.
That's great. I mean, that's an angle.
I've got to make myself laugh, otherwise what's the point? If someone else laughs, oh, that's a massive and wonderful bonus, but I've got to do what I think's funny, otherwise not what I think you think's funny. Or maybe this year I'll branch out. Here you go. Now what you want.
Are you happy?
Not at the moment, no. Just in a kind of state of panic. I mean, this is a precise moment. It's lovely to talk to you. So, yeah, I'm totally happy. And seeing the garden through your eyes, yes. How beautiful it is. And, no, I just walk around the garden and go, this is paradise. Oh, look at that tree. Just amazing. But I do feel... That feeling I had, there's something like a sort of residual. I do have a residual, no, it's not even a feeling. I have a massive backlog of emails, just emails I haven't answered. But it's so like a friend of mine had a baby, a good friend, you know, a comic I've known for 30 years. A baby just over a year ago. I haven't congratulated him. It was because I was going to Melbourne and I'd left it a week and it was too late then, and it's got worse and worse. And anyway, so that sort of thing. Right, so there's that. But in addition to that, I've got a residual feeling that it's something I should have done or should be doing.
A permanent residual feeling.
Yeah.
Is there any conceivable end to the research project of your sense of humour? Do you see what I mean? Is there a satisfactory end point that you can perceive? Will you ever be able to
final
go...
joke.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you ever give that any thought? You know, is there any sense that there will be a satisfactory end to
your
work?
I think you just die in harness, that's it. Perhaps there'll come a point where, you know, for several years you've not thought of a new thing and it sort of fizzles out, you know, not with a bang but with a whimper. Or maybe it will... I think things will always make me... Well, I hope things make me laugh. I don't know what I'd be if I didn't laugh sometimes at things I thought. I think of a thing and some, you know, maybe I've trained myself to make myself laugh a bit. I don't know. But it's occupational hazard. But I remember having had a conversation with Paul Merton once about what the ultimate joke was. And I was saying, well, a definition of an ultimate joke would be something like the longest possible joke, not a Shaggy Dog story, but the longest possible joke where every clause within it is necessary for the punchline, and the punchline is worth the weight it carries before it. So, you know, the opposite of a one-liner.
Yes.
As many lines as
yes.
possible. That would be able to, you actually try and think of something like that, it all goes out the window, doesn't it? It's mostly a couple of sentences.
The closest example I can think of to that would be something... I mean, and it's still miles away, but Adam Bloom's joke, which you, if you bleep all the swearing, then in Morse code it spells out a rude word. I don't know if it actually did. I don't know if he, being Adam, he probably did go to the trouble to make sure that the Morse was accurate.
He probably did.
Just wrapping up, there's two other questions I want to ask.
Boom, boom, shake the room.
there's two questions I want to ask. One is about your mental health, your happiness. And I ask this of everyone, I don't mean specifically yours.
Good. Thanks.
But how happy are you with life? What sort of person are you? Do you get out of bed happy? Do you bounce back after difficulties in life, in your writing, your creative work, or in your normal life?
How happy am I? I think it's not like that. I mean, to me, happiness is set yourself a task and do it and feel relieved from that. That's a source of happiness. You know, I'm not sort of blissfully happy. All right, sort of level. I wouldn't say, you know, but I still get sort of an access of joy when a thought comes to me. So then, for that moment, like a little revelation. A sort of overall kind of glimpsing the future slowly on the way down, you know. Or maybe I'll do something else, right? I think, oh, you know, maybe, so there's that, you know, under 1080. But sometimes I toy with the idea, maybe I don't want to do this anymore. Maybe I should find something else to earn a living to pay for the bloody iPhones. And I thought, oh, maybe a maths teacher. You know, I like maths. Now, I run chess club at Risley Lower School, just over the hill, right, on Thursdays. So that's an hour or 45 minutes of just 12, 14 children chess sets. I set them up, I intervene, shut up, that sort of thing. You play chess or get out, you know. The knight, the knight's the only one that jumps. Okay, you know, I think, look at the board, think, you know, that sort of work. So I do that. And even then, I come away from that 45 minutes and I go, fucking hell, I couldn't be a teacher. imagine 30 of them all day. Just some of them, little, sort of really those kind of unruly boys. I don't know. I've had hits on, but maybe not. Maybe you know, you've got to have a certain. I'm not also not used to it. So it's been an interesting taste to do it. So I do think I'd like to do something else, perhaps as well. I don't know. So it's a certain sort of unfulfilled, like, not even with money, just, you know, 50. I'm going to die. We don't want to do, it's not like bucket list, like I you know, go up Everest or something. I don't know what it is, but I feel like there's something else I'd like to have done. But other than that, yeah, great. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, plant a bit more grass. Mowing the lawn. I mow the lawn. I never set out to have a lawn. I never wanted it. But once you've planted a lawn, and you've gone to a lot of effort to sift all that soil all around there, right, and turn it into a lawn, you've got to mow it. Right. You're burning up the planet. It's a strange meditative thing. But I quite enjoy it because it's in that, compared to writing, it's in that, you know, simple, achievable task. It's done. The lawn is mowed. Someone at the door. Ironically, whenever we have Just a Minute on, right, you know the bell? It's the same bell as our front door. Dog goes mad. Someone's at the door. One day it'd be Nicholas Parsons.
Very last question then. What would you have engraved?
It's like Columbo, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. What's the actual secret? Yeah, yeah. What would you have engraved? You can interpret this however you want. What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
Oh, yeah, I've already done that. Born in Edgware, raised in Watford, died all over the place. Easy.
Thanks, man.
So thank you to Simon. Thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me round your beautiful house and gardens and showing me your soil sieve. And if you'd like to hear more about some of Simon's inventions, you can go to comedianscomedian.com/extras for approximately 30 or 40 minutes more of additional conversation. Some of it about soil and some of it about riots, some of it about Banksy, and some of it, of course, about comedy and Simon's take on success. You can get that free MP3 by joining the mailing list at comedianscomedian.com/extras. Thank you to you for listening. I'm going to stick around and post-amble at you in just a moment, but that kind of... I can't say the magic words until it does it? Yes. Everyone's a comedian. 14th of August. Come along to that. Like I mean it. 3:45 p.m. from the 5th to the 27th of August at the Liquid Rooms Annex. I can't wait. I can't wait this year. It's so nice to be returning to a venue where last year I was there. It all worked. The staff are amazing at the Liquid Rooms. They look after us so well. It all just moves smoothly like clockwork. I'm very hopeful and confident that it will be the same again. And it's so lovely to be going back to a venue thinking, I don't even need to worry about that. The show's kicking ass. I don't need to worry about that. I don't need to worry about anything. I just get to be in the same city as my family for a month and not drive anywhere, do shows every day, do myriad other little gigs and appearances and spots and bits and bobs. And that's why we go there. I can't wait. I'm so relieved. I will chat to you more about another big thing in my life in the post-amble in just a moment. But for now, that does indeed conclude the next week. Nick Cody? Maybe Nick Cody next week. And a frog in my throat the entire time. So just a little bit of chat. I've got a big birthday coming up in 2 days. By the time you hear this, I'm pre-recording this because I'm off to Latitude Festival to guest on the Level Up Human podcast. Oh, talking of other podcasts and appearances thereon, I did a chap called Reese did a podcast called After School, which I highly recommend you check out. And our own Daryl Smith, thanks Daryl of editing this podcast fame, had me on his show, which is called Things I'd Sooner Forget. You can find that on Twitter at I'd Sooner Forget. No apostrophe in I'd, of course. Come on, we're not lunatics. You talk about an object or some sort of tangible thing that you are embarrassed about, some element of it you're embarrassed or ashamed of in your past, Things I'd Sooner Forget, and then that leads into a wider conversation about who you were at the time. So I ended up talking in the After School podcast. I talked a lot about school and hating it. And, I don't know how positive it was, but it might be of interest to you. But in Things I'd Sooner Forget, I talk about my old street performing bowler hat. Fiercely proud of street performing, as you know. The bowler hat itself, Well, you will find out why I chose to get into juggling bowler hats, and I try to be candid about some of the terrible decisions that teenage Stu once made. And it led us down a really interesting path into talking about a lot of stuff that I've never talked about before and probably never will again in a public format forum. So, or format. So check that out. That's Daryl's podcast, Things I'd Sooner Forget. Hey, you know all of that advertising I did for Daryl's podcast? Hashtag thanks, Daryl. It's actually called I'd Sooner Forget This, and I got that wrong all the time while I was mentioning how great it was. Daryl asked me to revoice that bit of the podcast so that I could fit it in, but I can't remember any of the things that I said, and I'm away enjoying my birthday now, as you will hear later in the post-amble of this episode. So if you look for Daryl's podcast and you can't find it, that's because it's called I'd Sooner Forget This, and Daryl will have to be happy with this. Thanks, Daryl. So, coming up tomorrow to me now, and minimum 4 days in the past from when you listen to this, I've got quite a big birthday coming up. I'd like a huge one, like a one that I can't believe. I cannot believe I'm going to be 24 years old. It's a big birthday, guys. I'm going to Latitude Festival by way of appearing. No, I don't mean appearing, but I'm appearing on a pod while I'm there. I'm not gigging there, but I'm mostly going to Latitude in order to have this lovely birthday, to be at a festival and not work very much. Of course, me being me, I've taken on lots of additional little gigs and things, but it's one of those big birthdays where you reflect upon your life and think, Christ, is this it? As you know, I'm very happy, very pleased to have achieved, I've unlocked wife and baby just before rolling under the slamming stone temple door that is my birthday, and just reaching back, grabbing my hat, and there we go, nailed it. I think I worried a lot about aging for the whole of my life, all of it, between the ages of 16 and, God, for many years after the age of 16, I would routinely worry about my birthday every night, and every night before, and I'd really get stressed about it, as if I could do anything about it. Absolutely. I mean, what a typical description of what worry is. Hey, you can do absolutely nothing about this. Why not let it occupy your every waking moment? I used to worry about it a lot. And recently, I haven't worried for years. And now I don't know if I'm worrying. I'm just like, oh, God, this is the big one, guys. This is the big one after. This is sort of the last one that matters. I think at this point is what did Barry Cryer and Willie Rushton sing in Old Farts, Two Old Farts in the Night? For on now on, it's downhill slowly on the bus. I suppose something I talked to my brother last night and I suddenly realised, this birthday has made me realise that when you see older people, like much older people, you sort of assume they're kind of fine with being old. You're like, oh, they've, whoever they were when they were young, they've transformed into a different person now, an older person who's happy being old. This has made me realise I'm like, oh no, God, no. I'm still 23, aren't I? I'm still in my early 20s with a whole life ahead of me. And I mean, thank God I know now what I know now. God, I did a gig in Totnes the other night. Lovely for Big Mouth Comedy. Very pleasant it was too. And I went to college very near Totnes. I lived in Totnes for 3 years while I went to the crazy hippie wacky art college I went to, which is no longer there, sadly. I believe it's moved. And it really made me realise, walking up and down the high street in Totnes, oh my God, when I was last here, I was scared. I was living quite a scared life. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know if I was doing the right thing. I went to that college for love, like a fool. But I, you know, it was a series of questionable decisions at the time. And it just made me realise that me, who I was in my very early 20s, I just walked around frightened of life and frightened of decisions. I mean, we all know I've got a good deal of option paralysis even now, but at least I know who I am. And it just really made me reflect on that moment when I became a street performer and how much that, you know, I only mention all the times I care about it so much, how much that for me was a solidifying of identity. Like, this is who I am. Finally, I know who I am. And then, of course, I got, you know, frustrated with elements of that. And then when I became a comic, I went, no, this is who I am. And to go back there is actually to remember very vividly in a very evocative way, oh God, remember who you were when you didn't know who you are? You know what I mean? That's not a well-articulated subject. But yes, every time you think, God, what am I doing with my life? Just remember how much more screwed you were and clueless and befuddled and scared and bewildered 10 or 20 years previously. So that's something to think about, isn't it? I don't know. Am I nervous? I suppose I am nervous. This is the last time I will record a podcast before this big birthday, the number of which I cannot bring myself to say. Ah, so long. So long, young Stu. So long, first half of life, Stu. Now you're into second half. Open brackets. Half? Four question marks? Close brackets? You know. But at least I get to do it knowing who I am. Got my team. Got my base. Got you guys. Got my job. Got all the things. People start respecting you. This has come up in dressing rooms a couple of times recently, where I've said to comics who are my age or my age within comedy, just when you've been going 12 years, God, you've been going a while. I thought, yeah, it's been a while now, isn't it? I said to, I was backstage at the Comedy Store, clang, with Charlie Baker and Paul McCaffrey, and we kind of started a roughly similar time. And I said, guys, it's us now. And that's a nice feeling. And then obviously a 12-year-old open spot walks into the room and your heart breaks. But what I ended up thinking was, it's weird. When you stay in it for as long as we have, people start sort of automatically respecting you. You feel like if a younger comic is like, well, you know, you've been, you know, you're a real expert. I've got this mate who always tells me how great I am. He's a much newer act. And he's like, you know, you're a legend, mate. You're a legend. And I'm like, I'm not a legend. Can you stop respecting me? Because it makes me feel old. So that's the message. Just, if you see me in the street, guys, just don't respect me. I'll talk to you in the second half of my life. Oh, man. What was the... Well, there's a bit I add in the show, in Like I Mean It, that I've cut, which means I may save it for another show. But maybe I even told you about it before. Just that idea that for all those birthdays, all the, like, 16, 17, 18-year-olds do worrying, oh, God, I'm getting old, I never realised if I could go back in time and tell myself one thing, it would be that, don't worry, you and your mates all do this together. You all do it together. You all get your hearts broken together. You all panic about going to college or leaving college together. You panic about the world of work together. You know, someone gets married, you worry about marriage together. Yeah, you all get married together. And then one of you starts going bald. You all laugh at him together, Bennett. And the conclusion of the bit, which I could never quite make work on stage, is that the thing I wouldn't tell my 16-year-old self is, although that is true, it doesn't really matter because you never see your friends anymore anyway. Goldsmith out. No, I can't end it there. You do see your friends, just a lot less. And hey, here's a thing I keep meaning to point out, in much the same way as I feel I should frequently just randomly shout, wake up, eyes on the road, for those of you that listen to this whilst driving. Or run harder, to those of you who listen to this while running. Or, hey, time to relax, for those of you that listen in the bath. Something I always feel I should say is, hey, other comedians who I gig with a lot, who are my friends. Is there a way to say this without sounding needy? You know, you think we speak all the time because you listen to this? Just ring me. Let's leave it there. The pre-birthday pod. Guys, just pick up the phone, give me a ring. I'd ring you, only I've got a baby. If you're a mate of mine and you listen to this show all the time and you think we hang out and you don't have a baby, can you pick up the phone and give me a ring? I'd love to hear from you. Speak to you soon, guys. I'll talk to you when I'm old. Bye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.